Hello, Prestige Heads, Danny here. We're doing something a little different. As a lot of you might know, for the past few years, I've been working on a narrative podcast that I describe as the political economic history of grunge and Nirvana. More on that in the future, but for the podcast, I've done about 70 interviews with people associated with punk in the 1980s and 1990s. Steve Albini was one of them. Specifically, I interviewed Albini on August 3rd, 2020, during the height of COVID. In the interview, Albini and I talked about a lot of different things: his own experiences, the ethics of art under capitalism, recording and engineering, and much more. Steve was a legend, and as you'll see, a really great interview. And I thought that after his untimely passing, it makes sense to post that interview to give a sense of the man that he was. Anyway, here's the interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
So why don't we just get going? Could you introduce yourself?
You want me to introduce myself?
Yes, just say your name so we have it on tape.
My name is Stephen Frank Albini.
Great. And so can you maybe give a little background into how you entered into the music business, just a little brief biography?
When I was a teenager, I was in a punk band in Montana, and that inspired me to come to Chicago to go to college, because my presumption was that Chicago would have a good music scene. And when I got to Chicago, I got involved in the music scene here, the underground punk scene. And when you're in a band, you want to make recordings of your band so that you have something to remember the experiences by. So I started, I was sort of the designated person in every band I was in to do the recordings of the band so that we would have something to for posterity. And then when you're in a band, all your friends are in bands. And just by default, I became the responsible recording person for a bunch of my friends' bands as well. And then over time, that became sort of friends of friends, and then acquaintances of friends of friends. And eventually I became a professional recording engineer and opened a recording studio. And I've been making records in this basically the same circle of people since about 1981. And now I own a two studio facility in Chicago called Electrical Audio. And over the years I've recorded a lot of bands, like a stupid number of bands, but that it's the formative years of me being in a punk band and coming up through the punk circles and seeing the sort of independent networking of that world informed a lot of my practices, you know, in general, not just as a musician, but as a business owner, as an employer, as a person. Just, I came to very, very much value the community of people, or the creative community and the people around me who were my peers as musicians and my peers in the band. And that's basically where all of my interconnections have come from, is from just me being an active participant in the music scene.
So
I didn't have any formal training, and I wasn't part of any business. Like I didn't work my way up through the ranks of a company or anything. I just started making recordings of my band, and then carried on making recordings of my friends' bands, and then eventually that became my profession, and I've been doing it for a very long time.
So one of the things that we're really interested in is trying to get sort of the politics of these 80s punk and independent movements, you know, really to historicize them looking back.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about sort of that? We're talking in the Chicago scene in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Maybe could you talk about the politics? Like what were you all talking about? Were you talking about Reagan at all? Or was it just more divide?
The thing that's weird is that it, on a big scale, everybody had sort of shared progressive values, generally shared progressive values. But on a day-to-day basis, the local concerns were way, 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 way more important to everybody. Like there was a huge crossover in Chicago, huge cross-pollination between the punk underground and every other kind of underground. Like the queer Chicago was a big part of the early punk scene in Chicago, because a lot of the key figures were gay, and a lot of the venues that we could, that the bands could use, were off nights at gay bars, or, and there was a mixed audience. And so there was a big cross-pollinization there. And then it sort of had tendrils going out into every other kind of underground, like the criminal underground. Like there were, you know, drug dealers and prostitutes and like every kind of like petty criminal outsider, like literally every kind of freak and weirdo found a home in the music scene, in the punk scene in Chicago. So you'd go to a show and you would see just the strangest collection of people, you know, immigrants, homeless people, crazies, intellectuals, you know, like street corner anarchists, pamphleteers, trans people, queer activists. Like you would see just if you sorted society by, you know, the oddest freaks and just collected all of the oddest freaks into one place, that's what the punk scene was like in Chicago. And I took to it like a fish to water. It was just, it was the most invigorating group of people I'd ever been around.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. It sounds like a bohemian scene, which you don't often get in the United States. So you obviously, of course, met with a million bands and toured around. So would you say one of the things we're also trying to get is the distinctiveness of the so-called Seattle scene? Or was this, you know, there were, sure, a bunch of nodes. So could you talk a bit, do these scenes all have like a different character? Are they all kind of the same?
Well, the thing that's interesting is that there are a lot of personalities that sort of established themselves or like sort of made and had influence fairly early on. And Bruce Pavitt had his fanzine before he even went to Seattle. You know, and he had his cassette fanzine and the regular print fanzine. And then he ended up in Seattle, and it sort of made sense that he would become a pivotal figure in Seattle because he was already stirring shit up, you know, before he was there. And a lot of the early Seattle punk bands, just because it's difficult to tour from Seattle, didn't have much of a national profile. So bands like the U-Men or the Blackouts, who were terrific bands, really like exciting, invigorating bands, they were essentially unknown outside the Northwest just because of the physical location. And at the time, you know, there was no internet. So there wasn't really a good network for getting information out. And so if you had heard of one of these bands, if you knew about one of these bands and they came to town, you'd make a point of going out there. And, you know, both of those bands ended up crashing at my place when they played in Chicago. And I ended up, you know, sharing a bunch of information with them, so they could find other places to play in other cities and all that sort of, that was just the sort of natural networking that everyone in the punk scene operated by. Like whenever you'd find, you know, you'd hear of a band or you'd read about a band in a fanzine or some other band would say, oh man, there's this band from Winnipeg you have to go see, they're fucking insane. And then you would come across that band later and you'd make a connection with those people and they would share like, they would share their Rolodex with you and you'd share your Rolodex with them. Like there was a lot of networking, to use that corporate term, but it was all extremely informal and it was all based on this sort of common idea of trying to, you know, that we were all involved in one big project rather than it being a bunch of individual ambitious bands trying to make a name for themselves. Everybody seemed to realize that we were all in this together and that we were trying to make things cool in Sheboygan, you know. So,
right. So the way that you're describing it is, I would call it a communalist ethics, right? That there's an idea that across these cities in the country, there's a common project of punk.
Yeah. So very much.
So there's an ethics and an ethos, right? Like that's what I would call it. So is there a more, or did you, was there a more specific politics? What do I mean by that? Were you like, you know, fuck imperialism, you know, like we want more welfare or stuff like that.
No, I mean, there were people in the scene that would have particular agendas, and everybody was fine with everybody else having their particular agendas. And, you know, you would find sympathetic ears for, you know, radical lefty politics or anarchists, you know, and that sort of thing. But the kind of sloganeering and very specific identity stuff, like the sloganeering didn't come into it really until hardcore, until the punk scene sort of transmuted into the hardcore scene. And the hardcore scene was just more simplistic on every level. So rather than having a free-for-all where you just had a million different kinds of freaks, the hardcore scene was sort of codified into a specific type of politics, a specific type of music, a specific type of, you know, a specific look, a specific age bracket, you know, like that's where like slang and jargon started to kick in. It was a simplification and a stupidification of the sort of mayhem that was punk rock.
Could you maybe describe that transition a bit from punk into hardcore? Because I think that's a really important thing in the mid to late 80s that the kids today might not understand.
Yeah, well, the way, I don't know who I'm stealing this metaphor from, but it's definitely stolen. But punk was like a brilliant flash, an explosion, you know, something that was over in an instant. But it dazzled everybody that saw it, and it burned really long shadows, right? So, and every one of us that saw punk happen was changed by it. We were all dazzled by it, right? And we were all sort of carrying on in these shadows that were cast by that one singular moment. Punk rock was like a complete free-for-all, you know? You'd see the weirdest fucking people doing the weirdest fucking stuff and nobody would bat an eye, you know? And the freedom implied by that kind of acceptance or that kind of like boundary-less pavilion of perversions, right? That was the thing that was inspirational to me. Then there were certain tropes and certain motifs that started to develop as punk progressed away from this sort of crazy Dada beginning. And there was a kind of a reductionist mentality for the dumber people would see punk rock and think, they're wearing leather and playing fast. And then when those dumb people formed bands with other dumb people, they would be wearing leather and playing fast as like their entire identity. And then there were, you know, certain political insinuations made. And then those were adopted as kind of part, as almost as part of the identity of being a punk. Like people would be expected to like parrot anarchist sentiments or whatever without actually grasping anarchism, they would claim anarchy, you know. And I should point out that I don't have a problem with any of these things individually, but hardcore did become increasingly hidebound to a single style of music, a single look, a single mentality, a single politics. And I mean, honestly, of them all, the politics was just the part that I could get behind. But the rest of it, the conformity of it, the stupidity of it, the mind-numbing sameness of it, seemed like a capitulation to me. It seemed like a regression when the original idea of punk was that you can get away with anything and then everybody starts doing the same thing. It just seems ridiculous. It just seems like we've wasted an opportunity, you know? That was my reaction to hardcore, seeing hardcore evolve out of punk rock. Now, there were, you know, obviously, hardcore was a starting point for a lot of people who then matured and their ideas branched off and you had more and more interesting things develop after that. But the period where the initial flash of inspiration and creativity that was punk rock, where that as that sort of glimmered down, and what ended up sort of dominating the scene were these formulaic and very interchangeable hardcore bands. That was a pretty depressing development to me.
No, absolutely. So let's go back. So it's in the 80s. Sonically, you know, someone who's devoted their lives to music, would you say there was something unique about the bands that were coming out of the Pacific Northwest or associated with Sub Pop in terms of their like sonic character, or did they just sound like it from someone from Minnesota and Chicago and Austin or whatever it may be?
Every scene has their local heroes, and a lot of the bands in those scenes end up being influenced by their local heroes just because that's who you're in proximity to. So you had bands like the Melvins, who were an enormous influence on the Pacific Northwest. And a lot of bands that came out of there ended up having Melvins in their DNA just because that's where they descended from, you know. In the Midwest, you had bands like Naked Raygun and Killdozer and the Effigies, and those bands were hugely influential in Chicago. And there were a lot of bands that were sort of aping Naked Raygun. And Naked Raygun had, in their early days, had a kind of a chaotic tribal element, which was, you know, picked up by a lot of local bands. The Effigies had a more sort of straightforward, no-nonsense, tough guy rock image. And there were a lot of bands that kind of adopted that, the sort of working class, you know, lunch bucket, hard hat, lunch pail kind of mentality. And that was influential in Chicago. And in Madison and Milwaukee, you had bands like Die Preußen and Killdozer, and a lot of the bands in those places were influenced by those bands. There was a band called The Appliances in Madison, Wisconsin, who were a tremendous band, and they were sort of single-handedly holding up the scene in Madison. Like they would play every week, sometimes several nights a week, sometimes several sets a night, and they were bringing other bands with them on their short tours. And, you know, they were kind of looked up to by everybody in Wisconsin. And that, you know, that kind of local influence was huge. In Minneapolis, you had bands like Husker Du and The Replacements. And those bands ended up being huge influences on their peers in those cities. And that's true everywhere. So in Seattle, there were a few sort of Genesis bands like Green River and the Melvins, and to a lesser extent, the sort of punkier and poppier bands like the Fastbacks, and those bands influenced all of the other bands.
So what would you say describe the Seattle sound sonically, if the Melvins are the influence at Green River? Like, what makes that unique, if you could describe it musically?
There was a sort of trashy heaviness to a lot of the bands from Seattle that in other places there was a kind of an emphasis on the nerdier end of the punk spectrum, where you had scratchier, noisier, more minimal music. And, well, that was true in Seattle as well. You had bands like the Blackouts, who did have some of that sort of English influence. It seemed like there was more influence from traditional hard rock memes and tropes, and there were some elements of classic rock that weren't forbidden there. Like, you know, you could have a wailing frontman, or, you know, you could have a bridge in your songs, for example, and that was kind of forbidden elsewhere.
So did you associate that with Sub Pop? Was there an idea in other punk scenes of what Sub Pop was in the late 80s?
Sub Pop tried very hard to create an identity for themselves. You know, they had sort of standardized artwork on their records. They used the same photographer, Charles Peterson, I think is his name, for a lot of the imagery. They very much in the model of some of the English record labels of the time, like 4AD and Situation 2 and Factory. Like, they wanted to create an identity that the bands on their label could share, and that would create some notoriety for those bands without those bands ever actually having to leave town. like if you became associated with this thing and that thing was generally pretty good, that would make you predisposed to like that band. And it worked. Like, the, you know, they had a good graphic sense and their records always looked good and sounded good. And from a business aspect, just keeping records in print and in the hands of stores was extremely difficult during that era. And they were one of the very best at keeping records on shelves, you know, like making sure that the distributors had copies, making sure that the various writers in various cities had promo copies, making sure that the radio stations had copies. Like, they were very good at the sort of administrative aspects of running a record label. Granted, it was all done very dollhouse style. It was all done on a shoestring. But a lot of record labels, they would press up the records and put them in piles in the garage and then just hope to sell them, you know? And Sub Pop, maybe because they also had a storefront that they could work from, were sort of generally more serious about all of those aspects.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've heard a lot of stuff about that, but they were like bad on paying the bands, you know, and stuff like that. So
yeah, I mean, that I don't know what their internal logic is, but I know that at the time there was a very long lead time between you selling the records to a distributor and you finally getting paid from the distributor. Like, you sell the records to a distributor, they sell them on to a store, the store sells them or doesn't, and then either pays for them or returns them. And then the distributor either gets the money or doesn't get the money, and then they go through their internal accounting, and then they pay you for the records or they don't. And that whole cycle takes a very long time. It takes long enough that you could very easily sell a bunch of records to a distributor, and while waiting for the distributor to pay you, that distributor goes out of business. Like, that happens more times than I could count for those records that I was responsible for. So I don't want to absolve Sub Pop of any of their failings, but it was incredibly difficult to get all of the money that you had coming by selling records in the 80s.
That's really interesting. That's really helpful context. Thank you. So how did you first become professionally involved with any of this sort of Seattle bands, or become aware of them or want to work with them?
Well, I grew up in Missoula, Montana. So there was I still had some connections to the local scene in Missoula, and some of those people migrated to Seattle. And so I would hear from them what was going on in Seattle. Like, I had a friend, Randy Peprock, who was in a band with me when I was in Montana, and he moved to various places, but the first one was Seattle. And when he was there, he would send me cassettes send me stuff from the local bands. Like, I got a fart cassette very early on because he thought the name was funny, you know? And I got, you know, like, he, and there were other people from Missoula who moved there, some of whom ended up being involved in the sort of important Seattle bands, like Green River and Mud Honey and Pearl Jam. Like, some of those people came from my hometown. So there were social connections there. I didn't know those people, but I knew the people that knew them. And so there news would filter in about, oh yeah, this band Nirvana is going to be real big. And of course I would roll my eyes because no bands were allowed to be real big. So,
Jeff Ament is from Missoula, I believe. Yeah. Right? Yeah. So
he actually was instrumental in putting out that fellow that I mentioned, Randy Peprock, who was in the punk band that I was in Missoula. He started his own band called Who Killed Society. And they were the first punk band in Missoula, first proper punk band in Missoula. And I had recorded their demo in that capacity that I mentioned, where you're the guy that knows how to run a tape machine, so you get to record the band's thing. I recorded their demo. And last year, that demo was released by Jeff Ament and as a proper album. So that you get a window into what, like, you know, mid-80s punks in Missoula, Montana were thinking about.
That's really cool. That's awesome. They should do something at the EMP about that. That'd be really cool. So, of course, Nirvana, the big band. When did you first hear about them? What did you think about Bleach? What did you think about Nevermind? If you could take us through that whole story so we could get just the tape on that, because I think that'd be really important.
Yeah, I had heard Bleach. It made no impression on me. I had heard Nevermind. I remember hearing that Nirvana were going to be real big by a friend of mine who'd moved to Seattle. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders at that. I thought no bands get big or whatever. And then that record was ubiquitous. Like, you couldn't escape that record. And it was, you know, there were, MTV was still on every TV at everybody's house and at every bar. And they were all over MTV, and they were getting played on the radio constantly. And every sound man at every club loved that album and would play it before every band, you know. I have to admit, I'm fairly deaf to the charms of that record. I still, that record doesn't speak to me. There were other bands from Seattle at the time that I quite liked. Like, I thought Mudhoney were, in a messy way, were still a very invigorating band, still really good. And I loved the Blackouts. I thought the Blackouts were an amazing band. And they matured in a way that made them less interesting, but their early stuff I still think is really first rate. And then, as mentioned, the U-Man and Tad Doyle, I thought his band Tad was really, not just he as a guy, but I thought the band Tad was actually a really good band, and I enjoyed them. I thought the Melvins had a few interesting records by then. So, like, there was stuff going on in Seattle that I thought was interesting. But after working with Nirvana many years later, or years later, I came to admire and respect Nirvana as a band and Kurt as a musician. But I remain fairly immune to that to their first couple of records.
That's actually really interesting. I would just like to hear, like, because it was such a huge record, particularly Nevermind, like, do you not like the production? Do you not like the songwriting? Or what? That's not the phrasing. You know what I mean.
I couldn't really articulate, like, chapter and verse about what I dislike about the record. All I can say is that it didn't make much of an impression on me. It didn't seem special or good to me. I guess there was a kind of ambition about it that struck me as slightly unseemly, you know. By ambition, I mean, like, grasping for success or grasping for classiness or grasping for a sort of sanction. Something about that struck me as uncomfortable. But that's me, you know, fitting my feelings to a pattern after the fact. At the time, all I can say was I heard the record and it didn't impress me.
No, that's really interesting, because, like, the politics and the punk scene around the record is also something we're going to explore.
There was no politics about Nirvana. Like, everybody knew Nirvana were a legitimate band and they'd worked hard and they were embedded in the Seattle scene. They were friends with everybody. They were a local band that made good. There was no politics. You will hear some people invent a beef with Nirvana making it big. It's bullshit. No one begrudged them their success. Nobody thought it was bad that they were successful and made money. That's all external critical bullshit that's been applied, and that has been accredited to people in the underground. Oh, that they were bitter and that they hated Nirvana for selling out. Absolutely 100% not true. Nobody, I never heard anybody express that idea. That wasn't on my mind. That wasn't on anybody else's mind. That's just nonsense. There were bands in that were sort of manufactured grunge, like sort of bespoke manufactured bands that, you know, people were critical of and people were dismissive of, you know, like Pearl Jam, probably the best example, you know, where you had a band that was essentially fabricated to shop a demo, and then they got a record deal, and then, you know, were sort of insinuated or sort of imposed on a listening audience. You know, that's an aspect of the music scene that is entirely top down, like management driven, corporate driven, that people rightly rebelled against. And people were right to be critical of that kind of thinking and that kind of practice. Now, over the years, Pearl Jam have gone through great lengths to redeem themselves, and they've developed, ethics that are considerably above standard for a band in their station. But it's wrong to conflate people's distrust of a band like Pearl Jam with the success of Nirvana. It's absolutely wrong to conflate those two. The same with Sonic Youth. Like a band like Sonic Youth, who were a touring experimental band, who were friends and, you know, embedded in the scene with everybody else, and they graduated to an extent into a major label scenario. No one begrudged them that. It seemed like a stupid move in terms of longevity of the band, just because, you know, big record labels had a tendency to destroy the bands that signed to them. So it seemed ill-advised. And, you know, there may be an element of ambition there that's unflattering, but nobody begrudged them success. Nobody thought it was bad or evil for Sonic Youth to make money. You know, that's an argument, that's a straw man argument that's put forward as a way of delegitimizing any criticism of bands in the mainstream.
Thank you. That's super interesting. So one thing that I'd like to just push you on or ask you to talk about, particularly for younger kids who don't like have an idea about, you know, why ambition would be unseemly. Why would ambition be viewed as unseemly? And then also, like, what was the, so if you could talk a little bit more. So there was the idea that Nirvana was like an organic band that was actually connected to a scene. So if you could talk about why ambition would be unseemly, or just reflect on that. And then two, like, what was the view of Nirvana within the scene? Like, they're a great band that we're cool with them, or it's just they're one of us, so it's okay if they get money.
Well, if you go back to an earlier part of our conversation where me and all of my peers were inspired by punk rock, the thing that animated us about punk rock is that we were doing it for its own sake. It wasn't a tool by which we were going to build a career. It was, we wanted the world to be better. We wanted the world to be interesting. We wanted all of our crazy, freakish friends to thrive. We wanted to have cool shows to go to, cool artwork to see, cool people to hang out with. We wanted that to be the case. So all of our efforts were geared toward expanding and amplifying this oddball, weird, inclusive culture that we were part of, right? So when someone is de facto part of that, but uses it as a vehicle for personal aggrandizement or as a vehicle for professionalism or ambition, it seems like a betrayal of the entity itself. It seems like a betrayal of the project of making everything cooler by this one person being not cool, you know? And that mentality was, I mean, you could identify it early on by people doing it ironically. Like, bands would show up and ironically ask where the cocaine and the groupies were. Or bands would ironically request Courvoisier on their rider. You know, they'd be playing a squat and they'd ask for a bottle of Courvoisier, something like that. Like, I remember there was an interview with Jonathan Poneman where he was in his office at Sub Pop, and he had hired a masseuse to come and give him a rub down on his lunch break. And he joked to the interviewer about how corporate, you know, and how he was a big fat cat now because he could have get a massage on his lunch break in his office. You know, and there were guys that would like dress in a sort of a mock business suit and smoke cigars and like pretend to be ostentatious fat cats, that sort of thing. And that's the beginnings of it. There's this creeping, ironic professionalism that would creep into things. And you could tell as soon as that starts, you can tell within a few months, people are going to be doing that for real. And it absolutely happened. Every one of those people pretend, you know, if you pretend to be a scumbag, eventually you forget you're pretending and you're just a scumbag all the time, you know?
Yeah, it's like that saying, most truth is said in jest, especially initially. It's what they actually wanted in some way. So one thing that I, you're not a big fan of Nevermind. So how do you get in contact with Nirvana first? Like, when does Kurt Cobain contact you? What is the story behind that?
So post Nevermind, every now and again, I would get a strange slurring phone call at my home number from someone who I later found out was Kurt Cobain, very high, calling to talk to me. He never identified himself. He just asked me about other bands I'd recorded. He asked me about other bands in Chicago. He asked me about, you know, and it was just a conversation that I had with some drunken, you know, drunken or high person on the phone. I later found out, much later, that was Kurt. And he was sort of initially feeling me out to see if he would like me as a person and see if he could work with me. Then I started hearing rumors in the, you know, there were rumors being printed in the press, in the British press, that Nirvana were considering me for work on their next album. And those rumors were causing me a lot of trouble. Like, I was getting phone calls from journalists. I was getting needled by other bands. It was a modest but legitimate personal nuisance that Nirvana's name was being associated with me. And I had no official contact with them. I hadn't spoken to them. I wrote a letter to one of these newspapers that had published something about me being tapped to work on the next Nirvana record. And I said, I don't know where you're getting your information. I know nothing about this, you know. And when that letter, the letter where I said, I don't know what you're talking about, I've never been contacted by Nirvana, was published, shortly after that, Kurt called me and said, yeah, I'm sorry you heard about it this way, but we were thinking about asking you to work on this record. And then I had a fairly involved conversation with him about how I go about making records and what my thoughts about the way they should proceed were. And then after that conversation, I sort of typed up that my side of the conversation into a letter, which I then sent to the band so that they could just get an idea of how I wanted to do things and what I thought the best working methods would be.
Could you describe what that letter said? Like, what did you think they should do? That's really interesting.
Well, a band in their position would normally not be allowed to make very many decisions on behalf of their records. Like, they would be told which studio to use. They would be told what the producer was going to be. They would be given a budget, yada, yada. They were in a very lucky position in that they had already made a whole shit ton of money and they could operate independently. So my advice was that you should operate independently. You should make the kind of record you want and then just turn it over to the record label and say, here, this is our record. We're done with it. Now, there's a chance that they won't go for it because that would be a big paradigm shift. And if bands got away with that, then the record labels would lose a lot of power. And in the end, there was profound resistance to that as a working method. And the record label did try to get them to scrap the record and do it all again. They did scapegoat me. And all of that stuff was sort of laid out in that initial conversation. And essentially all of it ended up happening. But in the end, the band were able to put out the record that they wanted to. The record that made its way into the stores is precisely the record the band wanted to make it into the stores. And I consider it a pretty significant act of bravery on their part. They stuck to their guns and said, no, we like the record. We did this record the way we wanted to. We like it. We're putting it out. And I think that's incredible. Very few bands would have been able to stick to their guns like that.
That's really interesting. So before we get there, though, maybe we could go to the recording process. Like, one thing that we're trying to get, particularly about Nirvana, is like, what were the band dynamics like? What was it like to record with them? What was it like musically? You have so much experience. I'd love to just hear, like, if you could talk about them and then contextualize them maybe in larger things.
Well, bearing in mind that they and I had cut our teeth in the underground, where their budgets were very small, schedules were very short, time was very tight. They came to the studio very well rehearsed. They had already done demos of all of these songs in either at the Laundry Room or at the studio in Rio when they were down doing Rock and Rio. Dave Grohl was completely integrated into the band. He wasn't like the new guy or anything. It was a very normal session, and it that sounds like I'm ducking the question, but they were a band. They arrived with all of their gear. They didn't get lost in thought ever, you know, like every song they had a trajectory that they executed. They didn't chase their tails very much. There weren't a lot of experimental, like there was no navel gazing. Probably the most specific example of their efficiency was that when it came time for Kurt to do the vocals, he essentially sang the entire album in one session. Like, we started in the morning, did a few warm-up takes, made a few adjustments, and then over the course of that day, he essentially sang the entire album. Then the next day, he came back and added a couple of things and sang the remaining songs, and we were done. And that's, you know, that's a testament to his preparedness and also how clear he was about how he wanted everything to come out. He didn't have to try things a million times and hope that one of them was magic. He just, you know, cracked his knuckles and did it. And that is very much a product of having worked your way through the process of being in a band, starting from nothing, starting from having no support, no spare money, no spare time. You know, just the practice of efficiency was sort of ingrained in them.
That's really interesting. And we're not interested at all in gossip. I was wondering, so none of that. I was just wondering if you could, like, a band is like a family or at least a group of friends. Like, how did they, was like Kurt clearly in charge? What Kurt says goes, Dave play this drum part, Chris play that bass part. Could you comment on that?
I honestly can't speak to that. They behaved very fraternally when I was there. Like, everybody seemed to take everybody else into consideration. Obviously, like, they'd been through a lot by then. They'd traveled the world. There'd been, you know, overdoses and all kinds of internal drama. Like, and I didn't press them for any intimacy. Like, one thing I knew about that band was that there were a million people trying to sort of parasitically be part of their sphere of influence. Like, people who wanted to glom onto them one way or another. Like, ride their coattails or literally drain them in some way, you know? And I wanted it clear from the beginning that I wasn't going to do that to them. I wasn't going to capitalize on their name. I wasn't going to try to ingratiate myself to them. I wasn't going to try to insinuate myself into their circles. I was an employee of theirs. I was there to make a record for them, and that was it. So I never pressed them for any real intimacy. Like, over time, I've developed more of a friendship with Dave, and, you know, we communicate regularly and we get along well. And I was pleased that I was able to rekindle my friendship with Chris when Chris came to do the anniversary edition of the album. You know, and I admire them as people, and I'm pleased that we're on good terms. But while I was working for them, I was an employee. I was there to make a record at their direction. And so I couldn't tell you, you know, what happened when they left the studio, like who said what to whom. I couldn't tell you. I don't have any insight there.
No, for sure. So all the music was written when they arrived in the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And if it wasn't like formally, if it wasn't strictly written, they all knew how all the songs went. And then Kurt had in the back of his mind, he would have ideas for extra stuff that he wanted to do, or production effects, or, you know, additional parts or whatever. Like, he would have ideas for those, even if they hadn't ever been tried yet. He would have an idea. And so I think we were wrapped with all the recording and mixing inside of 12 days. And considering in Europe, like, bear in mind, this was sort of the shank of the CD era, where record labels were trying to maximize the amount of money that they made. And so they were really pushing the CD format. And the CD format's principal benefit over a vinyl LP was that it was compact and you could put a lot of music on it. So bands were being expected to deliver longer and longer records during the CD era. So Nirvana had been expected to deliver an album of 14 or 15 songs, something like that. And so they recorded a big batch of songs, like more than a dozen songs. I honestly don't remember how many. But to get that much music done in 12 or 14 days is even now would be something of an accomplishment, you know.
So could you describe your recording philosophy at the time?
Principally, I've always strived for naturalism. Like, not, I'm not saying like photographic realism, but I like the idea that when you hear somebody playing in person, if I were to record them, then the playback of the recording should evoke the sense memory of having seen that person play. You know, like every vocalist has a distinctive style. And the more production is brought to bear on a vocalist, the more you abstract the sound of that voice and remove that person from what makes them distinctive and unique. So I much prefer hearing someone's singing voice on sort of unvarnished to hearing like a studio production using the voice as an electrical signal, you know. I'm the same way with drums or a guy playing the guitar. Like, every drummer has a distinctive style, and the more you mechanize the production, the more you abstract the sound quality and the performance details, the more you lose what makes that drummer distinctive, and you start to make the drumming generic just by changing the sound quality so that it doesn't represent what that guy normally sounds like. And I'll give you another example. Like, Kurt had this broken Fender amplifier that he kept in his closet at home, and he would do songwriting on this broken amplifier. When I say broken, it was in the back of the amplifier, there are the power tubes that deliver power to the speakers. And three of those four tubes were broken. Like, the glass was literally broken off of the tubes, and the tubes didn't do anything. So there's only one working power tube in the amplifier. And what that does is it makes for a very strange distorted quality on that amplifier. But Kurt had become infatuated with that strange distorted quality, and he wanted to use that amplifier in the studio. Now, conventionally, you don't want to use broken equipment in the studio. You want to use equipment that's reliable and that sounds good and consistent, and that you know get a sort of classically good sound out of. But here was the thing that Kurt had. He'd written these songs playing this broken amplifier. He liked the broken sound of this broken amplifier. Of course he should be allowed to use that on the record. Of course, it's not even a question, right? But in a conventional production environment, he would probably have been argued away from it.
I just got to say, before we move on, I think it's the best drum sound I've ever heard on a record. I love the drum sound on In Utero. I think it is so, so cool. I grew up playing drums. It's the best drum sound still to this day. So,
I mean, I appreciate that you're thanking me for that, or that you're crediting me for that. But Dave Grohl is one of the top drummers ever to have lived. So, and I was lucky that he was drumming on a session that I was recording. It made my job pretty easy. And also, what you're hearing when you hear this great drum sound is what it sounds like when Dave Grohl plays the drums, you know.
So could you talk maybe a little bit about their musicianship, about the three of their musicianships, and also maybe Kurt's songwriting?
Yeah, I'm not the best person to talk about songwriting, but I do appreciate that Kurt's lyrics, at least, were intensely personal. And he would burrow into little manias of his in a way that allowed him to articulate them very genuinely. I think that's what people are responding to when they think of him as a songwriter. They're saying, oh, I'm getting a window into this guy's way of thinking, and he's expressing himself without candying it. So I'm hearing a fairly frank extrapolation on these ideas that he's got. So that's what people are responding to. The formal stuff, like verse, chorus, verse, pre-chorus, like, I don't know anything about any of that. That's all, you know, I'm not qualified to talk about that sort of thing. Dave Grohl is an absolute monster drummer. I've said this before. He's a very good general musician, as is evidenced by him playing guitar and singing and all, running a band and all these other things. But as a drummer, he is... he's a singularly great drummer. And he's credited with being a very powerful drummer, and that's true. But I think his sense of dynamics, his sense of dynamics and his subtlety are underrated. A lot of the songs, he's playing something very simple, just like a simple timekeeping with the bass drum and hi-hat, for example, and playing it very modestly. But that what that does is it gives him headroom to make the bigger parts bigger. And that's a subtlety that's lost on an awful lot of drummers. Yeah, I just can't say enough about how remarkable a drummer he is and how perfect he was for songs with those kinds of dynamics. And Krzysztof Veselich is a childhood friend of Bert's, and you can tell because his bass playing seems completely integrated into the way Kurt moves on guitar. Like, there's no surprises between the two of them. They seem very wedded together. And I think that, you know, that's a very flattering combination when you have bass playing that is as distinctive as the guitar playing, but seems to come from the same set of inspirations.
Would you mind saying distinctive in what way? Because we don't often hear about Chris's bass playing, but I think it's great. What do you mean?
Yeah. Okay, so of the sort of standard ways to play bass, a lot of them are sort of theoretical. Like every downbeat should have a bass note. Every chord change should be marked by a root note. There can be the occasional pickup or decoration, but the bass playing is meant to be sort of structural, right? And Trist's bass playing was much more fluid than that. So like if Kurt had a riff, there would often be a bass counterpoint riff that would run in parallel to it. That's what I mean by that they were integrated together. It wasn't that I'm going to play these chords and you just play the roots, or and it also wasn't the sort of hyperactive bass playing that seems to be paying no attention to the rest of the band. It wasn't that sort of acrobatic bass playing that is sort of trying to compete with the rest of the band. I think it's a very subtle and uniquely good relationship between the bass and guitar on that record at a minimum.
Yeah, it's so cool. Could you maybe comment on Kurt's guitar playing and particularly the vocals? We've talked to so many people, scholars of grunge, and they're like, it's the vocals. People have devoted their lives to this, man. They've devoted their lives to studying this stuff, but they all mentioned the vocals. Grunge. So could you maybe talk about the guitar playing and then really the vocals, which people mark as distinctive?
Yeah, I think Kurt, as a guitar player, is a very functional guitar player in that he learned how to play guitar well enough to execute his ideas and didn't feel the need to try to impress people by going farther. And I think that's an element of the sort of modesty or anti-virtuoso mentality that was pretty prevalent in the punk and the underground scene, was that if you're just doing fancy stuff to show off, you're embarrassing yourself, you know? So one way of avoiding that is by never developing the skills that would allow you to do fancy stuff. And so that was a practice of many people in the underground, was that you get good enough to do the things that excite you and don't learn techniques and don't learn like skills that would be intrusive if you were to ever use them. One way to think of it is like, if you're going shopping, you need a shopping cart, right? You don't need a Maserati to go up and down the aisles of a supermarket. And in fact, if you have a Maserati, it's probably way worse, you know? And if you really uncork the Maserati and find yourself like doing 130 down the aisles at Kroger, it's going to be a fucking disaster, right? So that's the way I would describe the sort of utilitarian playing that a lot of punk musicians have, is that it's perfect for the setting and anything more would be a liability.
And anything on the vocals?
Good vocals. I like the sound quality. I like the tonality of his voice, and he seemed very good at conveying the emotional content of the text. you know, I can't talk academically about singing. I don't know anything about it.
No problem. And I know you've taken a long time. So maybe if we could get your story on the drama that surrounded the record, because I feel like that's a big part of the Nirvana mythos. And you know, talking to you, if you could just give us the whole shebang.
I don't have the whole story. I have what I was subject to from here remotely. And that is that I had a conversation with Kurt after he turned in the record, and he said, everyone hates the record. They want us to do it over. And when he says everyone, what he means was his management team and all of the people that he was interacting with it at the record label. And I said, well, how do you feel about it? And he said, well, there's some things that we could do. There's some things I think we could improve on. And I said, well, tell you what, I'll listen. I had a copy of the master. So I said, all right, I'll tell you what, I'll listen to my copy of it. And if I think I can do better on anything, I'm happy to try to do some remixes for you. And you know, we'll have another conversation after I've listened to it. So I spent a day listening to the master and taking notes on it. And I called Kurt back and I said, you know, like, I really don't feel like I can do any better on any of this stuff. Like, I feel like we wrung the sponge, like we got every, you know, and sure, there may be moments here or there where this one vocal line could be louder or that one drum hit could be quieter, whatever. I don't remember what the conversations were. Like, there may be small moments here and there that I might be critical of, but the overall thrust of it is fantastic. And I feel like if we get involved in this nitpicking process, that it's going to be endless. That if you succumb to the anxiety that makes you want to remix things, eventually the whole thing is going down the toilet. And I just don't want to be a part of that. And I said very specifically, if you guys want to try to do some mixes on your own to see if you can do better, you have my blessing. I'm not going to bitch about it. But I don't feel like I should be, I don't feel like me pretending I'm unhappy with any of these will solve anything. And so they went off and they did remix a couple of songs that were released as singles. They were frank with me about doing it. It's not like it was a surprise. And then when the record was mastered, I mentioned that it was a long record, and there are practical problems with fitting a long record on a vinyl LP, which imposed limitations on the sound quality. And also they had gone to a sort of a notoriously manipulative mastering engineer, this guy Bob Ludwig, who had a kind of a reputation for doing quite a lot of work in mastering to records. And so it's no surprise that I was unhappy with the final sound of vinyl LP. I think it represents that record in a way, but it was a step down in fidelity from me listening to the master tape in the studio, you know. That's kind of to be expected, but it seemed like a bigger drop off in sound quality than I was expecting. But prior to the record's release, I had gotten a phone call this happened several times actually. I got a phone call from a journalist who I'm not going to name because he's a friend of mine and I don't want to put him on the spot. But I got a phone call from this music journalist who I had known for years. And he said, so I just got off the phone with Gary Gersh, who is the president of the record label. And he says that they can't release the Nirvana album and it's your fault. Can you comment? And I said, well, you know, like, what am I going to say? It's their record. They can do what they want with it. I did my best, you know. But what bothered me about the whole thing was that there was a concerted attempt to get the band to do things differently. And the mechanism that they used to try to get the bands to change their mind was they tried to embarrass them by going to the press and saying Nirvana have made an unreleasable, unlistenable, terrible album. And it's all Steve Albini's fault. And all we want them to do is make a normal record and they won't do it. Right. And that is unconscionable to me. Like, and every single person involved in that decision chain that brought them to the point where they were trying to discredit their own band and trying to talk shit about a record that should have been, that they should have been and were rightly proud of. Every single person involved in that decision chain should be ashamed of themselves forever.
And so how did your relationship with the band proceed? How did it resolve itself? They just released the record, right?
I mean, they just suffered all of this bullshit from all the people that they worked with. And they put their foot down and said, no, we like our record. We're putting our record out. Everyone around them was sort of begrudging that decision. And, you know, it wouldn't have surprised me if somebody inside the record company tried to torpedo that record, you know, sort of overtly torpedo that record, given the shit that they were willing to do to me. You know, it wouldn't have surprised me if somebody tried to tank that record, but I don't think that that happened. I don't think that there was an effort to tank the record. And the record, it was, you know, it was, they were the biggest band in the world at the time, and it was their new album. So, of course, it was going to be successful. But I think there was even some attempt to paint it as some kind of a disappointment because it wasn't, it didn't sell 20 million copies or something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite record of all time. So thank you for producing it, recording it. So
I got paid to do it, so I'm fine with it.
Perfect. So, like, what is your take on that, on sort of the whole, in retrospect? You know, it's a long time later. I think it was the last super mainstream guitar rock band. Pop music went in a different direction. What's your take as someone who was like one associated with the central band and just associated with hardcore and punk since the 80s? Like, if you're looking back on it now, what's your general perspective of Nirvana, of the scene, of all of it?
Well, there was a thing that happened after the Nevermind got super huge, which was that record labels started pirating bands willy-nilly out of local scenes. They started just like picking a random scene, find the biggest band in that random scene, offer them a deal, see if they turned out to be Nirvana, you know. And that was happening all over the place. And it was an enormously destructive thing. A lot of bands got signed on a whim, and then their records never came out and the bands got destroyed, or the record came out in a kind of a perfunctory way and they didn't become superstars, and that ended up being disillusioning, and just the amount of time that they were kept on ice waiting for the record to come out or waiting for a tour to be approved or whatever. Like, that period was enormously destructive to the underground. I don't blame Nirvana for that. What I blame is an institutionalized profiteering mentality that made it so that big record companies thought it was their obligation to try to vacuum up any available talent. And then if that talent that they vacuumed up wasn't successful, it was their obligation then to destroy those bands, you know, so that nobody else could be successful with them later. That whole thing, that whole corporate working method was just incredibly toxic. And I saw it play out in my friend circles, in my peer circles. And, yeah, I mean, there's not a lot good to say about the sort of corporate era of alternative music. You had these ridiculous fucking cattle calls, like, what's Perry Farrell's festival punk?
Lollapalooza.
You had like these, just these shit show things where you'd have like every wannabe superstar band, and then all of the promo darlings, like all the hype bands would be on those, like. And, you know, video channels are just being flooded with all of these videos from these faceless, like, sound-alike grunge bands. It was just a garbage era, you know. It was really destructive, and it was really uncomfortable to be around people who were genuinely trying to advance culture, and people who were working on their own in the underground to create a sustainable alternative lifestyle, sustainable alternative to a commercial entity, and then to see the corporate version of it just smash and grab and destroy an awful lot of bands. It was pretty depressing here.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like capitalism destroyed it, but it's interesting the movement didn't have more of a critique of capitalism, or at least that's what I'm interested today.
I mean, if you, when you say the movement, like if you talk to the bands on MTV, that were writing this gravy train briefly, all of them would say, yeah, this is great that you're on MTV. We're writing this gravy train briefly. 2 years later, of course, the band doesn't exist. Their records didn't sell and all their shit's in hock, right? But for the moment, no, there wasn't. Those people weren't critical of it because they thought they were exploiting it. You know, the people, you know, everyone who was in the legitimate underground, all of us who are still doing it today, for example, all of us recognized it for what it was, and we saw it as a sham, and we weren't shy about saying it, and we took a lot of heat for it. But I'm still here doing the same things that I was doing then. I'm still here saying the same things I was doing then. And it's not so much, like, I'm not particularly gratified that I was right, that all my friends' bands were going to be destroyed by this sort of creeping professionalism. That doesn't make me feel good, right? I do think that it's worth noting that there were people who identified this as an awful development at the time, and those people were dismissed at the time and proven right.
So just a question of clarification. You're critiquing corporations. Is there a criticism of capitalism as such, or is the corporation? It's a kind of a fine point, but I'm curious if people are criticizing the whole system, or don't like DGC. Or are we criticizing all of it?
It is possible to conduct yourself ethically within a capitalist framework. To the extent that you are a capitalist, you are corrupted. But it is possible to conduct, and I try to conduct myself this way. I try to behave as an honorable person within a capitalist framework that I'm forced to operate in, right? But I have a healthy suspicion of capitalism, and I think everyone in my position did during that era. And the distinction I would make between sort of small-scale entrepreneurial capitalism, which I'm uncomfortably finding myself part of, and large-scale capitalism writ large, is that capitalism writ large is about making money for the people who already have money and accruing power into the hands of the already powerful, right? Accruing and securing money and power into the hands of those already wealthy and powerful. Small-scale capitalism, like mine, is a guy wants to make bicycles, so he opens a bike shop. As a byproduct of that, money is going to have to change hands. And so he is de facto operating in a capitalist system, but the enterprise is he wants to make bikes. And so he's making bicycles. I want to make records in the studio. So I own a studio and I conduct business in a studio. I'm not doing it so that I can make money. I'm doing it so that I can make records, you know? A guy that opens a coffee shop, he's not opening a coffee shop because he wants to make money. He's opening a coffee shop because he thinks he can do it well and he thinks it would be a cool coffee shop. A guy that opens a record store, he's not opening a record store because that's a way to make a bunch of money. He's opening a record store because he loves record stores, you know? That's the difference between operating as an ethical person in capitalism and being a capitalist, where really all you're concerned about is making money. And so it's possible to operate ethically within capitalism, but it's insane not to be suspicious of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. That was really helpful. So you would say this whole 90s thing kind of destroyed underground guitar rock as like a mainstream phenomenon?
Well, you can't have an underground thing as a mainstream phenomenon.
Okay.
But what happened was that some of the aspirant people in the underground got their sparkle turn on the stage of the mainstream, got smacked down and disappeared. Those people who were committed to playing guitar carried on playing guitar. Those people who were committed to being in bands carried on being in bands. And, you know, a significant number of them realized that it was better to stay in the underground where all of your problems are manageable and all of your interactions are honorable, rather than try to graduate into a kind of a mainstream success. Very few people made it to a point of mainstream saturation and remained stable and happy there. Very, very few of them.
Yeah, I guess just the final question, then I'll let you go. Thanks for taking so much of your time. I guess what I'm really asking is, like, guitar rock is not at the center of the culture anymore. And I was wondering if you could
That's cool because it's, I mean, that's not a big deal just because, you know, it's an underground thing anyway.
Well, there's certain stylistic things peak in different eras, you know, and whatever kind of music you think is dominant now, if you come back in 20 years, it won't be dominant then. I don't think there's no point in having a position on that. It's like being disappointed that people aren't still doing the Hully Gully or whatever.
Well, you could say guitar rock from, like, let's say the 50s to the 90s was pop culture. And so that's not true anymore.
Yeah. I disagree.
Okay. No, that's...
You had all the sort of... Hello, Electrical. Hi, Don. Steve. Okay, I'll come back and let you in.
Thanks, Steve. Sorry to take so much of your time.
Not a problem. I got to split.
Really appreciate it, man. Have a good day.